Episode 94, The Early Life of George Washington.
Welcome to the Principles in Practice podcast. This is where we discuss biblical principles for life and learning. I'm your host, Heather Hall, and this is my co-host,
Brian Hall.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Principles in Practice homeschool podcast. In this episode, I'm going to share about the early life of George Washington. And this is in honor of his birthday and the character that he had developed throughout his lifetime. I'm sharing from a couple of primary resources. The first one is from The Life of George Washington. And the second one is from Women of the American Revolution by Elizabeth F. Ellett. So I'm going to share about Washington's boyhood, his early education, somewhat about his family life, and then I'm going to be segueing into the kind of woman that his mother was and the influence that she had on him during his boyhood. From The Life of George Washington. Not long after the birth of George, his father removed to an estate in Stafford County, opposite Fredericksburg. The house was similar in style to the one at Bridges Creek and stood on a rising ground overlooking a meadow which bordered the Rappahannock. This was the home of George's boyhood. The meadow was his playground and the scene of his early athletic sports. But this home, like that in which he was born, has disappeared. The site is only to be traced by fragments of bricks, china, and earthenware. In those days, the means of instruction in Virginia were limited, and it was the custom among the wealthy planters to send their sons to England to complete their education. This was done by Augustine Washington, with his eldest son Lawrence, then about 15 years of age, and whom he no doubt considered the future head of the family. George was yet in early childhood. As his intellect dawned, he received the rudiments of education in the best establishment for the purpose that the neighborhood afforded. It was what was called, in popular parlance, an old field schoolhouse, humble enough in its pretensions, and kept by one of his father's tenants named Hobby, who moreover was sexton of the parish. The instruction doled out by him must have been of the simplest kind, reading, writing, ciphering, perhaps. But George had the benefit of mental and moral culture at home from an excellent father. Several traditional anecdotes have been given to the world, somewhat prolix and trite, but illustrative of the familiar and practical manner in which Augustine Washington, in the daily intercourse of domestic life, impressed the ductile mind of his child with high maxims of religion and virtue, and imbued him with a spirit of justice and generosity, and above all, a scrupulous love of truth. When George was about 7 or 8 years old, his brother Lawrence returned from England, a well-educated and accomplished youth. There was a difference of 14 years in their ages, which may have been one cause of the strong attachment which took place between them. Lawrence looked down with a protecting eye upon the boy, whose dawning intelligence and perfect rectitude won his regard, while George looked up to his manly and cultivated brother as a model in mind and manners. We call particular attention to this brotherly interchange of affection from the influence it had on all the future career of the subject of this memoir. Lawrence Washington had something of the old military spirit of the family, and circumstances soon called it into action. Spanish depredations on British commerce had recently provoked reprisals. Admiral Vernon, commander-in-chief of the West Indies, had accordingly captured Porto Bello on the Isthmus of Darien. The Spaniards were preparing to revenge the blow. The French were fitting out ships to aid them. Troops were embarked in England for another campaign in the West Indies. A regiment of 4 battalions was to be raised in the colonies and sent to join them at Jamaica. There was a sudden outbreak of military ardor in the province. The sound of drum and fife was heard in the villages with a parade of recruiting parties. Lawrence Washington, now 22 years of age, caught the infection. He obtained a captain's commission in the newly raised regiment and embarked with it for the West Indies in 1740. He served in the joint expeditions of Admiral Vernon and General Wentworth in the land forces commanded by the latter and acquired the friendship and confidence of both of those officers. He was present at the siege of Cartagena when it was bombarded by the fleet and when the troops attempted to escalade the citadel. It was an ineffectual attack. The ships could not get near enough to throw their shells into the town, and the scaling ladders proved too short. That part of the attack, however, with which Lawrence was concerned, distinguished itself by its bravery. The troops sustained unflinching and destructive fire for several hours and at length retired with honor, their small force having sustained a loss of about 600 killed and wounded. We have here the secret of that martial spirit so often cited of George in his boyish days. He had seen his brother fitted out for the wars. He had heard by letter and otherwise of the warlike scenes in which he was mingling. All his amusements took a military turn. He made soldiers of his schoolmates. They had their mimic parades, reviews, and sham fights. A boy named William Bussell was sometimes his competitor, but George was commander-in-chief of Hobby's school. Lawrence Washington returned home in the autumn of 1742, the campaigns in the West Indies being ended, and Admiral Vernon and General Wentworth being recalled to England. It was the intention of Lawrence to rejoin his regiment in that country and seek promotion in the army, but circumstances completely altered his plans. He formed an attachment to Anne, the eldest daughter of the Honorable William Fairfax of Fairfax County. His addresses were well received, and they became engaged. Their nuptials were delayed by the sudden and untimely death of his father, which took place on the 12th of April, 1743, after a short but severe attack of gout in the stomach, and with but 49 years of age. George had been absent from home on a visit during his father's illness and just returned in time to receive a parting look of affection. Augustine Washington left large possessions, distributed by will among his children, to Lawrence, the estate on the banks of the Potomac, with other real property and several shares in iron works. To Augustine, the second son by the first marriage, the old homestead and estate in Westmoreland. The children by the second marriage were severally well provided for, and George, when he became of age, was to have the house and the lands on the Rappahannock. In the month of July, the marriage of Lawrence with Miss Fairfax took place. He now gave up all thoughts of foreign service and settled himself on his estate on the banks of the Potomac, to which he gave the name of Mount Vernon, in honor of the admiral. Augustine took up his abode at the homestead on Bridges Creek and married Anne, daughter and co-heiress of William Islet, Esquire of Westmoreland County. George, now 11 years of age, and the other children of the second marriage had been left under the guardianship of their mother, to whom was entrusted the proceeds of all their property until they should severally come of age. She proved herself worthy of the trust. Endowed with plain, direct good sense, thorough conscientiousness, and prompt decision, she governed her family strictly but kindly, exacting deference while she inspired affection. George, being her eldest son, was thought to be her favorite, yet she never gave him undue preference, and the implicit deference exacted from him in childhood continued to be habitually observed by him to the day of her death. He inherited from her a high temper and a spirit of command, but her early precepts and example taught him to restrain and govern that temper, and to square his conduct on the exact principles of equity and justice. Tradition gives an interesting picture of the widow with her little flock gathered round her, as was her daily wont, reading to them lessons of religion and morality, out of some standard work. Her favorite volume was Sir Matthew Hale's Contemplations, Moral and Divine. The admirable maxims therein contained for outward action as well as self-government sank deep into the mind of George and doubtless had a great influence in forming his character. They certainly were exemplified in his conduct throughout life. His mother's manual bearing his mother's name, Mary Washington, written with her own hand, was ever preserved by him with filial care and may still be seen in the archives of Mount Vernon, a precious document. Let those who wish to know the moral foundation of his character consult its pages. Having no longer the benefit of a father's instruction at home, and the scope of tuition of Hobby the sexton being too limited for the growing wants of his pupil, George was now sent to reside with Augustine Washington at Bridges Creek and enjoy the benefit of a superior school in that neighborhood kept by a Mr. Williams. His education, however, was plain and practical. He never attempted the learned languages, nor manifested any inclination for rhetoric or belles-lettres. His object, or the object of his friends, seems to have been confined to fitting him for ordinary business. His manuscript schoolbooks still exist and are models of neatness and accuracy. One of them, it is true, a ciphering book preserved in the library at Mount Vernon, has some schoolboy attempts at calligraphy, nondescript birds executed with a flourish of the pen, or profiles of faces, probably intended for those of his schoolmates. The rest are all grave and businesslike. Before he was 13 years of age, he had copied into a volume forms for all kinds of mercantile and legal papers, bills of exchange, notes of hand, deeds, bonds, and the like. This early self-tuition gave him throughout life a lawyer's skill in drafting documents and a merchant's exactness in keeping accounts, so that all the concerns of his various estates, his dealings with his domestic stewards and foreign agents, his accounts with government, and all his financial transactions are to this day to be seen posted up in books, in his own handwriting, monuments of his method and unwearied accuracy. He was a self-disciplinarian in physical as well as mental matters, and practiced himself in all kinds of athletic exercises such as running, leaping, wrestling, pitching quoits, and tossing bars. His frame, even in infancy, had been large and powerful, and he now excelled most of his playmates in contests of agility and strength. As a proof of his muscular power, a place is still pointed out at Fredericksburg, near the lower ferry, where, when a boy, he flung a stone across the Rappahannock. In horsemanship, too, he already excelled, and was ready to back, and able to manage the most fiery steed. Traditional anecdotes remain of his achievements in this respect. Above all, his inherent probity and the principles of justice on which he regulated all his conduct, even at this early period of life, were soon appreciated by his schoolmates. He was referred to as an umpire in their disputes, and his decisions were never reversed. As he had formerly been military chieftain, he was now legislator of the school, thus displaying in boyhood a type of the future man. The attachment of Lawrence Washington to his brother George seems to have acquired additional strength and tenderness on their father's death. He now took a truly paternal interest in his concerns and had him as frequently as possible a guest at Mount Vernon. Lawrence had deservedly become a popular and leading personage in the country. He was a member of the House of Burgesses, Adjutant General of the District with the rank of Major and a regular salary. A frequent sojourn with him brought George into familiar intercourse with the family of his father-in-law, the Honorable William Fairfax, who resided at a beautiful seat called Belvoir, a few miles below Mount Vernon, and on the same woody ridge bordering the Potomac. William Fairfax was a man of liberal education and intrinsic worth. He had seen much of the world, and his mind had been enriched and ripened by varied and adventurous experience. Of an ancient English family in Yorkshire, he had entered the army at the age of 21, had served with honor both in the East and West Indies, and officiated as governor of New Providence, after having aided in rescuing it from pirates. For some years past, he had resided in Virginia to manage the immense land estates of his cousin, Lord Fairfax, and lived at Belvoir in the style of an English country gentleman surrounded by an intelligent and cultivated family of sons and daughters. An intimacy with a family like this, in which the frankness and simplicity of rural and colonial life were united with European refinement, could not but have a beneficial effect in molding the character and manners of a somewhat homebred schoolboy. It was probably his intercourse with them and his ambition to acquit himself well in their society that set him upon compiling a code of morals and manners which still exists in a manuscript in his own handwriting entitled Rules for Behavior in Company and Conversation. It is extremely minute and circumstantial. Some of the rules for personal deportment extend to such trivial matters and are so quaint and formal as almost to provoke a smile. But in the main, a better manual of conduct could not be put into the hands of a youth. The whole code evinces that rigid propriety and self-control to which he subjected himself, and by which he brought all the impulses of a somewhat ardent temper under conscientious government. Other influences were brought to bear on George during his visit at Mount Vernon. His brother Lawrence still retained some of his military inclinations, fostered no doubt by his post of adjutant general. William Fairfax, as we have shown, had been a soldier and in many trying scenes. Some of Lawrence's comrades of the provincial regiment, who had served with him in the West Indies, were occasional visitors at Mount Vernon, or a ship of war, possibly one of Vernon's old fleet, would anchor in the Potomac, and its officers be welcome guests at the tables of Lawrence and his father-in-law. Thus, military scenes on sea and shore would become the topics of conversation. The capture of Portobello, the bombardment of Cartagena, old stories of cruisings in the East and West Indies, and campaigns against the pirates. We can picture to ourselves George, a grave and earnest boy, with an expanding intellect and a deep-seated passion for enterprise, listening to such conversations with a kindling spirit and a growing desire for military life. In this way, most probably, was produced that desire to enter the Navy, which he evinced when about 14 years of age. The opportunity for gratifying it appeared at hand. Ships of war frequented the colonies and at times, as we have hinted, were anchored in the Potomac. The inclination was encouraged by Lawrence Washington and Mr. Fairfax. Lawrence retained pleasant recollections of his cruisings in the fleet of Admiral Vernon and considered the naval service a popular path to fame and fortune. George was at a suitable age to enter the Navy. The great difficulty was to procure the assent of his mother. She was brought, however, to acquiesce. A midshipman's warrant was obtained, and it is even said that the luggage of the youth was actually on board of a man of war, anchored in the river just below Mount Vernon. At the 11th hour, the mother's heart faltered. This was her eldest born, a son whose strong and steadfast character promised to be a support to herself and a protection to her other children. The thought of his being completely severed from her and exposed to the hardships and perils of a boisterous profession overcame her resolute mind, and at her urgent remonstrances, the nautical scheme was given up. To school, therefore, George returned and continued his studies for nearly 2 years longer, devoting himself especially to mathematics and accomplishing himself in those branches calculated to fit him either for civil or military service. Among these, one of the most important in the actual state of the country was land surveying. In this he schooled himself thoroughly, using the highest processes of the art, making surveys about the neighborhood, and keeping regular field books, some of which we have examined, in which the boundaries and measurements of the fields surveyed were carefully entered and diagrams made with a neatness and exactness as if the whole related to important land transactions instead of being mere school exercises. Thus, in his earliest days, there was perseverance and completeness in all his undertakings. Nothing was left half done or done in a hurried and slovenly manner. The habit of mind thus cultivated continued throughout life, so that however complicated his tasks and overwhelming his cares, in the arduous and hazardous situations in which he was often placed, he found time to do everything and to do it well. He had acquired the magic of method, which of itself works wonders. And now we'll turn to Women of the American Revolution by Elizabeth F. Ellet to learn more about Washington's mother. Mary Washington. The mother of Washington! There needs no eulogy to waken the associations which cling around the sacred name. Our hearts do willing homage to the venerated parent of the chief, who mid his elements of being wrought, with no uncertain aim, nursing the germs of godlike virtue in his infant mind. The contemplation of Washington's character naturally directs attention to her whose maternal care guided and guarded his early years. What she did and the blessings of a world that follows her teach impressively, while showing the power, the duty of those who mold the characters of the age to come. The principles and conduct of this illustrious matron were closely interwoven with the destinies of her son. Washington ever acknowledged that he owed everything to his mother in the education and habits of his early life. His high moral principle, his perfect self-possession, his clear and sound judgment, his inflexible resolution and untiring application were developed by her training and example. A believer in the truths of religion, she inculcated a strict obedience to its injunctions. She planted the seed and cherished the growth, which bore such rich and glorious fruit. Lafayette observed that she belonged rather to the age of Sparta or Rome than to modern times. She was a mother formed on the ancient model, and by her elevation of character and matchless discipline fitted to lay the foundation of the greatness of him who towered beyond all Greek, beyond all Roman fame. The course of Mrs. Washington's life, exhibiting her qualities of mind and heart, proved her fitness for the high trust committed to her hands. She was remarkable for vigor of intellect, strength of resolution, and inflexible firmness wherever principle was concerned. Devoted to the education of her children, her parental government and guidance have been described by those who knew her as admirably adapted to train the youthful mind to wisdom and virtue. With her, affection was regulated by a calm and just judgment. She was distinguished, moreover, by that well-marked quality of genius, a power of acquiring and maintaining influence over those with whom she associated. Without inquiring into the philosophy of this mysterious ascendancy, she was content to employ it for the noblest ends. It contributed, no doubt, to deepen the effect of her instructions. The life of Mrs. Washington, so useful in the domestic sphere, did not abound in incident. She passed through the trials common to those who lived amid the scenes of the Revolutionary era. She saw the son whom she had taught to be good, whom she had reared in the principles of true honor, walking the perilous path of duty with firm step, leading his country to independence, and crowned with his reward, a nation's gratitude. Yet in all these changes, her simple, earnest nature remained the same. She loved to speak in her latter days of her boy's merits in his early life and of his filial affection and duty, but never dwelt on the glory he had won as the deliverer of his country, the chief magistrate of a great republic. This was because her ambition was too high for the pride that inspires and rewards common souls. The greatness she discerned and acknowledged in the object of her solicitous tenderness was beyond that which this world most esteems. The only memoir of the mother of Washington extant is the one written by George W. P. Custis, the grandson of Martha Washington, and published more than 20 years ago in his Recollections in the National Gazette. These reminiscences were collected by him in the course of many years, and to them we are indebted for all that is known of the life and actions of this matron. According to these, she was descended from the respectable family of Ball, who came to this country and settled on the banks of the Potomac. In the old days of Virginia, women were taught habits of industry and self-reliance, and in these, Mrs. Washington was nurtured. The early death of her husband involved her in the cares of a young family with limited resources, which rendered prudence and economy necessary to provide for and educate her children. Thus circumstanced, it was left to her unassisted efforts to form in her son's mind those essential qualities which gave tone and character to his subsequent life. George was only 12 years old at his father's death and retained merely the remembrance of his person and his parental fondness. 2 years after this event, he obtained a midshipman's warrant, but his mother opposed the plan and the idea of entering the naval service was relinquished. The home in which Mrs. Washington presided was a sanctuary of the domestic virtues. The levity of youth was there tempered by a well-regulated restraint, and the enjoyments rational and proper for that age were indulged in with moderation. The future chief was taught the duty of obedience and was thus prepared to command. The mother's authority never departed from her, even when her son had attained the height of his renown, for she ruled by the affection which had controlled his spirit when he needed a guardian, and she claimed a reverence next to that due to his creator. This claim he admitted, mingling the deepest respect with enthusiastic attachment and yielding to her will the most implicit obedience, even to the latest hours of her life. One of the associates of his juvenile years, Lawrence Washington, of Schoetank, thus speaks of his home. "I was often there with George, his playmate, schoolmate, and young man's companion. Of the mother, I was 10 times more afraid than I ever was of my own parents. She awed me in the midst of her kindness, for she was indeed truly kind. And even now, when time has whitened my locks, and I am the grandparent of a second generation, I cannot behold that majestic woman without feelings it's impossible to describe. Whoever has seen that awe-inspiring air and manner so characteristic of the father of his country will remember the matron as she appeared, the presiding genius of her well-ordered household, commanding and being obeyed. Educated under such influences, it is not to be wondered at that Washington's deportment towards his mother at all times testified his appreciation of her elevated character and the excellence of her lessons. On his appointment to the command-in-chief of the American armies," said Mr. Custis, "previously to his joining the forces at Cambridge, he removed his mother from her country residence to the village of Fredericksburg, a situation remote from danger and contiguous to her friends and relatives. There she remained during nearly the whole of the trying period of the Revolution, directly in the way of the news as it passed the mother, trusting to the wisdom and protection of divine providence, preserved the even tenor of her life, affording an example to those matrons whose sons were alike engaged in the arduous contest, and showing that unavailing anxieties, however belonging to nature, were unworthy of mothers whose sons were combating for the inestimable rights of man and the freedom and happiness of the world. When news arrived of the passage of the Delaware in December 1776, the mother received calmly the patriots who came with congratulations, and while expressing pleasure at the intelligence, disclaimed for her son the praises in the letters from which extracts were read. When informed by express of the surrender of Cornwallis, she lifted her hands in gratitude towards heaven and exclaimed, 'Thank God, war will now be ended, and peace, independence, and happiness bless our country.' Her housewifery, industry, and care in the management of her domestic concerns were not intermitted during the war. She looketh well to the ways of her household, and worketh willingly with her hands, said the wise man, in describing a virtuous woman, and it was the pride of the exemplary women of the day, of that day, to fill the station of mistress with usefulness as well as dignity. Mrs. Washington was remarkable for a simplicity which modern refinement might call severe, but which became her not less when her fortunes were clouded than when the sun of glory arose upon her house. Some of the aged inhabitants of Fredericksburg long remembered the matron, as, seated in an old-fashioned open chaise, she was in the habit of visiting, almost daily, her little farm in the vicinity of the town. When there, she would write about her fields, giving her orders and seeing that they were obeyed. When on one occasion an agent departed from his instructions, she reproved him for exercising his own judgment in the matter. "I command you," she said, "there is nothing left for you to do but to obey." Her charity to the poor was well known, and having not wealth to distribute, it was necessary that what her benevolence dispensed should be supplied by domestic economy and industry. How peculiar a grace does this impart to the benefits flowing from a sympathizing heart! It is thus said that she has been pictured in the imagination of one of our most gifted poets. Mrs. Sigourney Weaver, in her poetical tribute on the occasion of laying the cornerstone for the monument. Methinks we see thee as in olden time, simple in garb, majestic and serene, unawed by pomp and circumstances, in truth, inflexible and with a Spartan zeal, repressing vice and making folly grave. Thou didst not deem it woman's part to waste life in inglorious sloth, to sport awhile amid the flowers or on the summer wave, then fleet like the ephemeron away, building no temple in her children's hearts, save to the vanity and pride of life, which she had worshipped. Mr. Custis states that she was continually visited and solaced in the retirement of her declining years by her children and numerous grandchildren. Her daughter, Mrs. Lewis, repeatedly and earnestly solicited her to remove to her house, and there pass the remainder of her days. Her son pressingly entreated her that she would make Mount Vernon the home of her age. But the matron's answer was, "I thank you for your affectionate and dutiful offers, but my wants are few in this world, and I feel perfectly competent to take care of myself." To the proposition of her son-in-law, Colonel Lewis, to relieve her by taking the direction of her concerns, she replied, "Do you, Fielding, keep my books in order? For your eyesight is better than mine, but leave the executive management to me." Such were the energy and independence she preserved to an age beyond that usually allotted to mortals, until within 3 years of her death, when the disease under which she suffered, cancer of the breast, prevented exertion. Her meeting with Washington, after the victory which decided the fortune of America, illustrates her character too strikingly to be omitted. After an absence of nearly 7 years, it was at length, on the return of the combined armies from Yorktown, permitted to the mother again to see and embrace her illustrious son, so soon as he had dismounted in the midst of a numerous and brilliant suit. He sent to apprise her of his arrival, and to know when it would be her pleasure to receive him. And now mark the force of early education and habits, and the superiority of the Spartan over the Persian schools, in this interview of the great Washington with his admirable parent and instructor. No pageantry of war proclaimed his coming, no trumpets sounded, no banners waved. Alone and on foot, the Marshal of France, the General-in-Chief of the combined armies of France and America, the deliverer of his country, the hero of the age, repaired to pay his humble duty to her, whom he venerated as the author of his being, the founder of his fortune and fame. For full well he knew that the matron was made of sterner stuff than to be moved by all the pride that glory ever gave, or by all the pomp and circumstance of power. The lady was alone, her aged hands employed in the works of domestic industry, when the good news was announced, and it was further told that the victor chief was in waiting at the threshold. She welcomed him with a warm embrace and by the well-remembered and endearing names of his childhood. Inquiring as to his health, she remarked the lines which mighty cares and many trials had made on his manly countenance, spoke much of old times and old friends, but of his glory not one word. Meantime, in the village of Fredericksburg, all was joy and revelry. The town was crowded with the officers of the French and American armies, and with gentlemen from all the country around, who hastened to welcome the conquerors of Cornwallis. The citizens made arrangements for a splendid ball, to which the mother of Washington was specially invited. She observed that although her dancing days were pretty well over, she should feel happy in contributing to the general festivity, and consented to attend. The foreign officers were anxious to see the mother of their chief. They had heard indistinct rumors respecting her remarkable life and character, but forming their judgment from European examples, they were prepared to expect in the mother that glare and show which would have been attached to the parents of the great in the old world. How were they surprised when the matron, leaning on the arm of her son, entered the room. She was arrayed in the very plain yet becoming garb worn by the Virginia lady of the olden time. Her address, always dignified and imposing, was courteous, though reserved. She received the complimentary attentions which were profusely paid her, without evincing the slightest elevation, and at an early hour wishing the company much enjoyment of their pleasures, and observing that it was time for old people to be at home, retired, leaning as before on the arm of her son. To this picture may be added another. The Marquis de Lafayette repaired to Fredericksburg, previous to his departure for Europe in the fall of 1784, to pay his parting respects to the mother and to ask her blessing. Conducted by one of her grandsons, he approached the house when the young gentleman observed, "There, sir, is my grandmother, Lafayette, beheld, working in the garden, clad in domestic maid clothes and her gray head covered with a plain straw hat, the mother of his hero, his friend, and a country's preserver." The lady saluted him kindly, observing, "Ah, Marquis, you see an old woman, but come, I can make you welcome to my poor dwelling without the parade of changing my dress." To the encomiums lavished by the Marquis on his chief, the mother replied, "I am not surprised at what George has done, for he was always a very good boy." So simple in her true greatness of soul was this remarkable woman. Her piety was ardent, and she associated devotion with the grand and beautiful in nature. She was in the habit of repairing every day for prayer to a secluded spot formed by rocks and trees near her dwelling. After the organization of the government, Washington repaired to Fredericksburg to announce to his mother his election to the chief magistracy and bid her farewell before assuming the duties of his office. Her aged frame was bowed down by disease, and she felt they were parting to meet no more in this world. But she bade him go with heaven's blessing and her own to fulfill the high destinies to which he had been called. Washington was deeply affected and wept at the parting. The person of Mrs. Washington is described as being of the medium height and well-proportioned, her features pleasing, though strongly marked. There were few painters in the colonies in those days, and no portrait of her is in existence. Her biographer saw her but with infant eyes, but well remembers the sister of the chief. Of her, we are told nothing except that she was a most majestic woman and so strikingly like the brother that it was a matter of frolic to throw a cloak around her and place a military hat upon her head, and such was the perfect resemblance that had she appeared on her brother's steed, battalions would have presented arms and senates risen to do homage to the chief. Mrs. Washington died at the age of 85, rejoicing in the consciousness of a life well spent and the hope of a blessed immortality. Her ashes repose at Fredericksburg, where a splendid monument has been erected to her memory.
As always, if you're looking for additional resources or support, you can visit our website at principalacademy.com, check out our shop and our blog, and you can also find us on Facebook at Christian Homeschooling with Bible Principles, also on Instagram under Principal Academy. Thanks so much for joining us.
All right. Well, this is Heather Hall.
And this is Brian Hall.
For Christ and His glory.